My name is Ben Barrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Well, welcome back to the show. What an album we're looking at today. What a record we're looking at. A really, really good album today. We're going to start our journey with The Freewheeling. Before we go there, just a quick reminder, there is a new episode of Blood on the Tracks out as we speak. This is my favourite episode so far, I think. It's all about the Rolling Thunder review tour, which was, you know, mad, wasn't it? Also, we have a look at Bob's bittersweet relationship with Joan Baez, and there's a really nice bit of the episode where Dylan tells us the story of the Lafayette bar shootings that Reuben Carter somehow got entangled with. So that's all in the latest episode of Blood on the Tracks. I'll put a link in this episode's description. Go and check it out if you haven't done so already. Also in the episode's description is a link to the extra episodes on Patreon. It's £5 a month for you to get a weekly show. At the moment over there, we're having a look at the Oh Mercy album in depth, an incredible record. We have a look at its origins, at the themes of that album, obviously the songs and the collaboration between the artist and the producer. I'm loving doing that at the moment, and they're available on the Patreon feed as we speak. Let's say hello to some subscribers who are there. Hi to Raphael Larito. Hi to Benjamin. Hi to Michael Cormier. Hi to Vilda Fossid. Hi to Taj Hams. Hi to Noel Rachetti. Parker Sterney, hello. Mary Jane Parker, hello. Ray H, hello. And hi to James Firebrand as well. You can sign up for an extra show on Patreon right now. The link is in this episode's description. Thank you in advance. Let's get to today's episode, shall we? So, speaking of multi-part looks at an album, let's have our first look at The Freewheeling. You know, an incredibly important album for Dylan. His first album of note, I think it's fair to say, an album where it all begins, and it features some classic songs, two of which we'll look at in today's episode, as well as the origins of the album. Let's have a look at 1963's The Freewheeling.
Carina, Carina, get where you've been so long. Carina, Carina, get where you've been so long. I've been worried about you, baby. Baby, please come home.
As 1962 drew to a close, Bob Dylan's debut album was struggling to sell 5,000 copies. Eventually, it would just about break even. It was, though, a disappointment, especially considering that Dylan had been brought to the label by legendary Columbia talent scout John Hammond, a man who would help discover Aretha Franklin and sign both Springsteen and Cohen. In fact, Dylan, for a short time, was considered one of Hammond's rare misses. Bob was referred to as Hammond's folly, suggesting that Dylan was his kryptonite, if you like, his one blind spot when it comes to talent. There was even some minor talk of Dylan being dropped by Columbia, but this never really seemed to be anything concrete. Still, what they did have from that debut was green shoots of a career. Dylan's performance on the LP, and particularly the song Song to Woody, were signs there was more to come from this artist. So they would try again. And things would be similar. There wasn't a major overhaul to speak of. Things pretty much stay the same for this album, for now, anyway. Like the debut, they would record in New York at Columbia's Studio A. The record would also be produced by Hammond, who had produced the debut album. The infamous Albert Grossman had become Dylan's manager by this point too. He'd been one of the many would-be managers that had courted Dylan in the early Greenwich Village days. He became Dylan's manager on August the 20th, 1962, and he was famously aggressive, fierce even. And by the time it came to Bob's second album, he could feel this was a make-or-break situation for not only his clients, but for him. Grossman and Hammond didn't see eye to eye. Grossman felt that Columbia was not working hard enough to promote his artist, so much so he even asked his lawyer, David Braun, to draft a letter to Columbia stating that their contract was invalid because Bob was under 21 when he signed it. Hammond was unsurprisingly upset. Here was Bob, a man he had taken a swing on, a swing that looked more and more like a big swing after the underperformance of his debut album, and now he wanted out. It would work in Bob's favour, though. Grossman doubled down, and from that moment, Columbia's attitude changed towards Dylan. They started promoting him more. And that would start with his second album, The Freewheeling. For the record, they entered the studio on the 24th of April 1962. It was Dylan and Bill Lee on bass in that first session, and it was the start of a difficult recording process. It was a process that would span 8 different sessions, a whole year, and 2 producers. The growing tension between Grossman and Hammond, which had started with that contract dispute, came to a head with a recording of a song that didn't even make it onto the album, but would change it forever. The tune was Bob's first single, Mixed Up Confusion. They cut it on November the 14th. Grossman had decided he'd wanted to get rid of Hammond, and so he set about playing the producer. He demanded Dylan's backing band play a Dixieland style for the song. Hammond was confused and obviously agitated at this suggestion. He knew it was deliberately provocative, but he did make several attempts to try and get the sound that Grossman apparently craved. None worked, somewhat unsurprisingly. He eventually lost his temper and he ordered Grossman's partner, John Croft, out of the studio. Bob became so frustrated with the whole thing that he walked out. Shortly after this session, Hammond reportedly resigned from the album. Fast forward to April 1963, and only 2 sessions later, Dylan is back in Columbia's Studio A. There is a new producer sat the other side of the glass, Tom Wilson. The mood in the room is lighter, and they cut the album's second track, Girl from the North Country.
If you're traveling in the North Country fire, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline.
But this is not where the song's story begins. Far from it, in fact. The song's story actually begins more than a year earlier and on a different continent. The first time Dylan went to London, it was cold, really cold. The UK was under what would be known as the Big Freeze.
It was the worst blizzard for 15 years, and in southern England, the worst avalanche of snow in living memory. Again, it was the southwest that bore the brunt, but it swept all the south and east of England. There were gusts of nearly 90 miles an hour, and it was bitterly cold.
Dylan was in London for the first time, unbelievably, to make his television debut. Yes, he wasn't even a star yet, but he was due to make his acting debut in a BBC play, the director of which had seen Dylan perform in Greenwich Village, stateside, on a trip, and had brought him to the other side of the Atlantic. Doesn't seem like the best idea, and as we'll see, it wasn't really. Unsurprisingly, given what would follow, Dylan ended up not really acting in the play. Instead, he played the role of a young singer after a rewrite. Even that wasn't too much of a stretch for Bob. But that's a story for another day. The trip isn't really about this BBC play. The trip is Dylan getting inspired. He's exposed to a lot of traditional English folk songs during his time in London, and like we heard in the last episode of this podcast, that starts to present itself in his work. Again, like we heard in the last episode, British folk legend Martin Carthy is quoted as saying that Dylan's trip to London was crucial for his development. And while his time in the English capital would present itself on albums after The Freewheeling, there's still some grassroots in these compositions that come later in the sessions on this LP. On the trip, Dylan apparently writes songs like Boots of Spanish Leather and a song called Farewell, which ends up on the Whitmark Demos bootleg. He also writes another song called Liverpool Gal, which you can find on the internet. He hears some classic British folk songs like The Patriot Game, an Irish ballad with lyrics written by Dominic Byam. From this, Dylan takes the melody for his song, With God on Our Side. However, it's another traditional British folk song that inspires him the most during his time in London. Its name is Scarborough Fair.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary and thyme.
Not only does it form the base of Boots of Spanish Leather, but also Girl from the North Country.
If you go when the snowflakes storm, when the rivers freeze and summer ends.
While there's some debate about who Our Girl from the North Country is, there's a couple of obvious muses. One being a very early serious girlfriend of Bob's, called Bonnie Jean Beecher. Bonnie loved blues music. She regularly visited New York and she bought records by obscure artists. Apparently she knew even more than Bob about the blues and music in general, which impressed him immensely. The other possible muse is, of course, Suze Rotolow. Or Susie Rotolow. Suze and Bobby had been an item on and off for a while in Dylan's early New York days, but Suze had gone to Italy to study, and it would appear their on-again, off-again relationship was off again. It feels like the almost sister song to this, Boots of Spanish Leather, is definitely about their relationship. Dylan appears to paint the picture in that song of a transatlantic love as he's pining for his woman. On Girl from the North Country, though, it's a little less on the nose. It's a little less sure it's about Suze. But I can't help but feel, given the similar tone in the songs and almost identical sonics, they might just share a story too. With Suze stationed on Italian shores, Bob found himself not too far away from his love during his little London jaunt. So, on the 5th of January, he headed to Rome. He'd gone on the premise that he was going to see the folk singer Odetta, who was a client of Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, who also went on the trip with him. But we know his real intentions. However, in a cruel, almost bad sitcom-style twist of fate for Dylan, Rotolow had already returned to the United States, leaving about the time that Bob arrived in Italy. He apparently finished writing the song under the Italian winter sun. The song shares the sentiment of Boots of Spanish Leather and of future songs like If You See Her, Say Hello. It's the sort of remember me to her type of love song, a love song about divided and defeated lovers, a song of muted smiles and fond memories. Dylan sings, "Well, if you go when the snowflakes storm, when the rivers freeze and the summer ends, please see if she's wearing a coat so warm to keep her from the howling winds." Perhaps some of those lines were inspired by that cold London winter. He manages to capture that feeling of fresh love in this song, of young love, but also that feeling of sadness. I'm sure we've all had that pining emotion, and here it's described in a song. Dylan, as is possibly his greatest skill, manages to get onto tape a feeling that you can have in your soul. He somehow manages to articulate that in verse and notes. He creates something physical out of a mere emotion. I love the first harmonica solo in this song leading to that final verse. It sounds like he's playing candlelight, actual candlelight. The solo after the verse is almost arresting. It gets to guitar feedback type levels.
So if you're traveling the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine.
And so in our story, winter gives way to spring, and Dylan, long after leaving Italy, cuts the song in two takes in New York in that final freewheeling session with Tom Wilson. The second one is the one we hear on the LP, and we get a great Dylan vocal. Interestingly, they return to the song later in the session. In fact, they give it four more goes, but those don't seem to be overdubs or anything completing the original track. In fact, there's nothing to really overdub on these sparse recordings, so we can assume they went back to it to see if they could do it another way. But ultimately, the second take stuck and ended up on the album. Sadly, those other cuts aren't in circulation at time of records. A couple seem to be false starts anyway, so perhaps any new idea that they were working on wasn't quite working right from the off. But the song itself does come pretty quickly and easily in the studio. And that's the case for the album opener, too.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must...
Blowing in the Wind, like we've seen a few times on this podcast and like we hear more than a few times in Dylan's back catalogue, is a universal song. There's a funny lyric from a band I enjoy called Art Brut. Their debut single is called Formed a Band, and the band's very self-referential lead singer, Eddie Argos, sings the lyric, "We're gonna write a song as universal as Happy Birthday." Which, from a music business point of view, is kind of the end game. It's the ultimate thing you're looking for from a music business point of view, once again, I'd like to point out. Maybe not from a creative point of view. And despite Eddie's glib line there, Dylan gets pretty close to that sort of universal song. With the mega buck selling of Dylan's back catalogue to both Universal and Sony in different deals, Bob is cashing in on the fact that he does have songs like this, those universal songs once again. Excuse the pun. This song is in the same league as Imagine or Billie Jean or Bohemian Rhapsody. It's not just a song, it's a piece of pop culture. No wonder people were willing to pay so much money for them. You are literally buying culture. And unlike some of those other songs, Dylan doesn't need theatrics or opulent sonics or even a clear, concise social message. Blowing in the Wind achieves this status with minimum fuss. However, it isn't universally loved by all. Folk singer and Bob friend Pete Seeger said that Blowing in the Wind is, quote, not my favourite. It's a little easy. Another folk singer, Tom Paxton, is more annoyed about it. He says, I hate the song myself. It's what I call a grocery list song where one line has absolutely no relevance to the next line. And, well, maybe he has a point. Because while Blowing in the Wind for me is a song I really enjoy, with lyrics I really enjoy, I don't feel it's necessarily a song that really holds all the answers. And that's kind of the point, I guess. Obviously, the questions in it are rhetorical. Dylan manages to give us the sort of pondering that only a young mind can muster. There's a feeling of motivation behind those words, like they themselves are an agent of change, like the person speaking them could influence all of history. But Dylan manages to couple this youthful exuberance with a strange wisdom. It's a heady mix of the both. The opening line of "How many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man" sounds like the sort of pondering you'd get from a person of Dylan's age at that time, or at any time. In fact, it sounds like a bit of dialogue from The Graduate even. It's anxious and questioning and full of desire for change. This is also represented with a sketch that Dylan has since done of the song. In 2019, there was an art exhibition in London's Halcyon Gallery called Mondo Scripto. Dylan hand-wrote a set of lyrics and sketched an image to visually represent each song he wrote the lyrics for. I saw them up close. They were stunning. In the sketch for this song, he pictures a young man at a literal crossroads, with different US locations on a signpost in front of him. Iowa and Kansas are detailed amongst others. It looks like the image that embodies those youthful-sounding lines. But then, alongside these in the song, we also have them coupled with lines that sound like they are being spoken by a wise man, in the form of lyrics like, "Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it's washed to sea? Yes, and how many years can people exist before they're allowed to be free?" That final line there obviously makes us think of the civil rights movement. In fact, civil rights campaigner and singer Mavis Staples expressed her astonishment on first hearing the song. She said she could not understand how a young white man could write something that captured the frustration and aspirations of black people so powerfully. And while I'm sure this is referenced throughout the song, it's not just a song about civil rights and civil rights alone. Blowing in the Wind feels like a song that is asking us to consider our values, our culture, and society in a variety of ways on a variety of issues. It's a song that manages to question everything without ever being really specific. In many ways, the song, like the answers it details in its refrain, always seem just out of reach.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
The This, though, really is a hopeful song of change. While it's cloaked in sadness and almost exasperation with lines like "and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free?" and "how many years can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see?" we always return to that refrain of "the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind," which for me has felt like Bob is noting the answers to these problems are out there somewhere. There is hope for this. It can be fixed. Some have read these lines as the answer being all around us, ever present, invisible like the wind itself, except we don't see them. And whilst I do like this idea, I don't feel this is a song of muted anger or bitterness at people doing wrong in the world, at people missing things that are right in front of them. I detect little anger in these lines, or in Dylan's delivery, more a desire for change. In the song, like we go on to see many times, there's possibly a trace of biblical verse. In the Old Testament, in the book of Ezekiel, there's a quote that reads, "Son of man, thou dwellest in the midst of a rebellious house, which have eyes to see and see not, they have ears to hear and hear not." Which could form the basis for Dylan's "yes, and how many times must a man turn his head pretending he doesn't see? Yes, and how many ears must a man have before he can hear people cry?" And while we could probably crowbar any lyric of Dylan's or anyone's into a biblical quote and vice versa, those lines about not seeing and hearing people cry do have biblical undertones. We hear stuff like that mentioned in the Bible a lot. Their imagery is similar to themes that you find in that book. So I don't think we can rule this out completely. The song itself, though, was performed live for the first time in April 1962. It comes at Gurdy's Folk City in New York. What's striking about the song is Dylan's performance. He doesn't sound phased or shy. He's dead on the money with this song straight away.
"The answer, my friend, is blown in the wind. The answer is blown in the wind."
However, performances like this one caused a slight problem for Bob. A New Jersey high school student called Laurie Wyatt would perform the song for his school. This happens in November 1962, and crucially afterwards, he claims he wrote it. His school paper reports the song was a Wyatt original, and his claim was repeated in a now infamous Newsweek story about Dylan in 1963. They write, "There is a rumour circulating that Dylan did not write Blowing in the Wind, that it was actually written by a New Jersey high school student who sold it to the singer." Newsweek said in their November 1963 issue, "Dylan says he did write the song, and Wyatt denies authorship, but several students claim they heard the song from Wyatt before Dylan ever sang it." It's good to see that fake news is alive and well, even in the 60s. Of course, the conspiracy theory on this eventually died down, and died down pretty quickly. And by the summer of 1963, the song had become a big hit for Peter, Paul and Mary. They released a cover version of it, and it hit number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100. Another song in Dylan's live repertoire at the time is a tune called "No More Auction Block for Me." And this is where Blowing in the Wind gets a lot of its melody from, as Dylan continues the folk borrowing tradition we saw with Girl from the North Country. Here is Odetta's version of "No More Auction Block for Me."
"No more auction block for me. No more, no more. No more.
All things considered, Blowing in the Wind has become an archetype of the folk song. It borrows from the genre's roots, it drives for change in the tradition of Woody Guthrie, and it manages to be poetically profound in just 3 chords and not even 3 minutes of a runtime. And whether Bob likes it or not, it really did capture a moment and a generation. Young people had become agents of change, and that had never been so prevalent as it was in the 60s with its clashing of ideals and problems that needed to be sorted between generations. And here was one of the younger generation, with a hopeful air suggesting that change is out there somewhere. It is possible. The culture of Dylan and his like in the 60s were positive. They wanted peace. They felt the world could change for the better. And this song seems to channel all of that. And like all things that blow up, it comes at just the right time. While people often sniff at the statement that art can change the world, it really can. And with current world events accelerating as I record this podcast, we do a good job to remember the final lines in the song's final verse, as Dylan sings, "Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows too many people have died?" Almost 60 years later, and I'm afraid the answer is still blowing in the wind.
Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
That is it for this episode. Share your thoughts on the Freewheeling, please. I mean, I think it's one of Dylan's best. I don't think it is his best, but you can't argue with the songs. You can't argue with that track listing, can you? As always, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter with this podcast at Bob Dylan Podcast. In this episode, we talked about Dylan's trip to London and also his relationship with Suze. Both of those subjects have been covered on the Patreon feed. In fact, I did a special episode about Suze and Dylan's relationship. Her book, A Freewheeling Good Time, is a really nice read, actually. It's quite a sad read, but an interesting read. She gives an interesting account of Dylan in those early days. It's not a kind of kiss and tell book, which I was worried it would be. It's much, much better than that. So I can fully recommend that, and I can fully recommend the episode on Patreon on their relationship, and also the episode on the Patreon feed about Dylan going to London. Like I said in this episode, it's such an important, crucial moment for him going to London to be inspired for a few albums actually in a row. We cover that in an episode called Dylan's Coldest Winter, and this is a clip taken from it. On Saturday the 15th of December 1962, Bob Dylan flew into Heathrow Airport. It's the first time he's left the US. In just over a month, he would debut Blowing in the Wind on television, he'd gain his first acting credit, and be inspired to write some of the best songs of this era. Not to mention cutting an album too. This is Dylan's Coldest Winter. Hear the full episode and many more like it on the Patreon feed right now. Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra is available over there. There's a link in this episode's description. And I'll be back next week with another look at the Freewheeling. Until then, take care of yourself and I'll see you down the road.